Hello and welcome to episode 55 of the Tech Reformation, where the world of technology meets the worldview of Christianity. I'm Ben.
I'm Craig.
And I'm Derek. How you guys been, man? It's been like a week or two since I've seen you. It's been 2 weeks.
Oh yeah, you were away last week.
I was very sad.
That's right.
It was okay. It was a good night to get out and just do nothing with my wife. It was much needed. And we were very grateful for you guys for covering for me last week.
Always happy to
no
do
worries.
That.
All good.
Especially for somebody's wife. Like, totally. I'm there for that.
Mm-hmm.
Wives are number one. Podcast is number two.
Well, God's number one.
Three or four or five. Well, obviously, Craig.
Sorry, I just had to juke the situation.
Jesus,
I'm on the list of wife and podcast. Podcast is two.
Okay, yep.
Yes, there we go. So follow-up this week. So after, what was it, now, 2 weeks ago, whenever I was on last, I talked about my phone and how I have this quarter of an eyelash stuck on the screen of my phone.
So gross.
Yeah.
So weird.
And whose eyelash is that? We don't know.
Somebody from China.
Oh my gosh.
Chinese eyelash.
Oh my gosh, this is getting... No, just stop.
Smog infused eyelash.
But David McCookie in the chat just said whenever he got to that part, Derek, just replace your phone. Just replace your phone. And I'm like, okay, I could replace my phone. It is still under warranty. And certainly even under like the 30-day whatever or 90-day warranty of once you get your phone replaced, so automatically like 90 days put on after that. But I really hate the process for replacing a phone through Verizon. And I have to replace my phone through Verizon every single time. This is just basically a barrier of entry as far as just how inconvenient it is to have to navigate Verizon's phone tree, try to get a hold of customer service on Verizon. Okay. You know what happens when you go into, you know, Verizon's automated helpline and say, okay, I need to replace my phone. You know what happens?
No.
Okay. It tells you, okay, thanks for calling or whatever. Please call this number on a different phone so that our customer service can help you troubleshoot the stuff on your current phone so that we can do that. And I understand.
Can't you just speakerphone them and do the same thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, if they need you to turn off your phone and turn it back on, or, you know, do a hard reset, or, you know, that kind of thing. I understand why they need to do this, but I really wish they would give an option for the people who are, like, smart about phones to just talk to a customer service representative and say, okay, I've gone through all of this stuff that you can ask me already. Please just replace my phone. That, and I'm pretty sure that my company is starting to look at me sideways, like, okay, this is how many times you've replaced your phone. Like, I have such bad luck with phones. This is like the third company phone that I've got that has had a problem. And
I don't think this one's a problem. I think it's just it's an endearing quality.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the thing. And this,
as
this
in
phone,
maybe it is annoying, but you could just put up with it and it doesn't affect anything other than.
Exactly right. See, I am perfectly happy putting up with this phone because it is not too bad. And if all I have for the entirety of this phone's life is a tiny little quarter of an eyelash on in my screen that I see every time the phone starts up and every time there's a white screen somewhere, I'm okay with it.
No way.
Are you sure the eyelash isn't in your eye?
Just one of those little things that follow you around as you look different places.
Is the eyelash on your computer screen right now, Derek?
Oh my goodness.
Maybe it's on your glasses.
We solved it. We didn't even need a Verizon call.
Man. So anyway, that's why I'm not getting my phone replaced for this one.
Yay. until the next issue you find with it.
Until the next issue. Until my phone explodes or something.
Until you realize that you shouldn't have got space gold and you should have got something different.
Yeah, yeah.
Returning anyway. To old jokes. Ben's shaking his head. Like a dog returning to its vomit. Pretty sure it's in the Bible somewhere. Anyway.
And after this past week's episode, which I quite enjoyed, by the way, fellows, Hayden hit up the Slack to bring his thoughts on why tech environments get toxic. What'd you guys think about this list? Oh, I guess, should I just read them?
Yeah, okay. For anybody who's not in the Slack, which, by the way, you should get in the Slack, but yeah, let's read them for those folks.
Okay, so first, highly competitive and easy to enter the marketplace, especially for developers. When you're a developer, you're competing with anyone with a laptop, kind of. Second, the insane amount of money involved from VCs, which leads to monetization difficulties. Third, a constantly changing skill set. Not only do you have to do your job, but you need to make sure that you are keeping your skills modern. Fourth, the ease of copying tech. And fifth, you don't have to be in the office to work, so it is easier than ever to work from home.
I only had some questions around why he thought working from home or working remotely would lead to a more toxic workplace. I still don't think that it does. I do it all the time. But the other ones, I think, are great.
I think if your company has an issue with good communication, then yeah, it can. But that wouldn't necessarily be prompted by working from home, I think. But yeah, all the rest of them were great. I think, like, my personal thought would be really that because it's so competitive in a tech marketplace that it very much leads to a money-focused, success-focused outlook, and not caring so much about the employees so much. Like, the employees are just tools to an end and not people. I think that's probably the main problem when it comes to toxic tech environments. But
was this just your way to get into the discussion last week, Derek?
A little bit. That's what it turned into just now, actually. I wasn't planning on that, but, you know.
I caught you.
Even when Derek's away, he's not really away. He's always got an ear out.
That's right.
Well, you could have just edited yourself in, I guess. So,
That would have been tedious. It's always tedious.
Just have all these really awkward breaks at the end of our discussions where Derek says something and then no one responds.
And then at the end, why is no one listening to me?
Four.
So Craig, you're having issues with iOS 10?
I don't love it. I mean, there's no major issues that are like, oh, this really has broken my phone or made something impossible that I used to be able to do. It's not like that. It's just, I think I see what they were trying to do with iOS 10, and I feel like it's one of those releases that they'll get lots of angry customer feedback because sometimes people actually don't like a lot of change. Mm-hmm. And so I think in the next couple of months, I'm hoping and I'm thinking we'll start to see some updates come out where they make some of the things that they've currently got as standard optional. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about the like double tap to log in thing.
Mm-hmm. Which you can change,
that
actually.
Just really, sorry?
You can change that that feature, the way that works for you, actually. I haven't done it. I don't know exactly where it is, but I know there's a setting. People have talked about it, that you can change how you log in on your iPhone there.
Right. I've had a look.
To go back to the original.
I've had a look and I couldn't see it, but maybe I just haven't dug far enough. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. The other thing is I think swiping left and bringing up all the crap that mm-hmm. comes up, like all the up next on your calendar and Siri app suggestions. Like, what is that? Like, that's just Apple advertising that they've changed the way Siri works. I don't need to see that. The weather and my Wonderlist. I know you can edit that list.
Derek's going to have a complaint with all of these complaints.
If that's not a,
Derek,
that's not
Derek,
a legitimate
Derek, I know
complaint.
You can change it. I know it's customizable, right? I guess what I'm saying is I just preferred... I was happy with Spotlight, like just swiping left and seeing Spotlight. If I want to see that list of things, then like some people will love it. I get it. I just don't love it. So that's a personal thing, and I understand that.
Craig and is I know pretty you picky, can... and I think we've all learned. And I think Derek is pretty quick to defend Apple.
Hang on, I'm quick picky. To is that what you said? Sensible suggestions.
Sensible suggestions.
I'm not that picky, am I? Derek's the one who changes his phone every 5 minutes.
Well, continuous improvement model of living, you know.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, the other thing is just it's just a design thing. So I get that, like with the swipe up screen from the bottom, which I like. I like how they've laid that out. It looks pretty neat. And I like that when I swipe to the right of that, it shows me what I'm currently playing in Pocket Cast.
I think that's awesome. I love the swipe really right good. For music thing.
Yeah,
that's
cool. It looks so much better. Podcast,
yeah.
Okay, I've been looking this entire time for this fictional setting that lets you not have to push the home button to unlock your phone, Derek, and I've not found it yet.
Is it in accessibility? They usually shove all the strange settings in accessibility.
I don't know.
But even that is a weird thing. What's that about? Why do they put everything in accessibility?
You know, for people who need help with using their iPhone because they don't have, I don't know, as functional hands.
Ah, there it is. Okay.
You found it?
Settings, general, accessibility, and then home button. And then there's a switch that says rest finger to open, which is turned off by default.
Ah.
That's how you do it.
I'm trying to find it.
Setting, got it. Done.
So it's settings, general, accessibility,
yep.
Home button, and then rest finger to open. That's where it is. Six steps. Is that right? Settings, general, accessibility, home button, rest finger to 5 steps. That's a lot.
Mine is actually on by default. How about that?
Maybe it's because your phone is older.
Yeah, probably. I have noticed, like, the more that I play with iOS 10 on my wife's phone, which is a 6S, the more I am positive that iOS 10 was engineered around the 6S.
Oh yeah, it totally is. It's because the reason they did the press is because the Touch ID works so fast on the 6S.
Absolutely.
Because of the processor and the new specs that people were just totally missing their notifications and blowing past them.
That,
and so they made it press so that you could decide when it opens up.
That and 3D Touch is magical now. Like there are so many things that are really good with 3D Touch now. As far
for
as notifications
some values, it's magical.
And shortcuts on the home screen. I mean, shortcuts on the home screen existed before, but there's so many like functions as far as that goes.
For some values of magical.
Yeah.
If magical equals gimmicky.
It's not gimmicky anymore.
Did you know that you can 3D touch?
This is becoming
in
a whole podcast
center?
About this, by the way.
Did you know this?
Say what?
Okay, you know how I discovered this because the camera app, your 3D touch, it lets you do front camera or rear camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the flyout menu.
Yeah.
But I have hidden my camera app because I don't need it because it's in Control Center. You can do 3D touch to get the flyout menu on the Control Center button
nice.
For the camera. Isn't that crazy cool?
Yeah, it's very cool.
I love that.
It's turned into a great like a right-click feature now. In that, like, it's not necessary to operate your phone, but if you know that it exists, it makes the experience so much better.
I wish Peek and Pop was more implemented.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, there's my thoughts on iOS 10, since I didn't get to comment on that last week either.
Great.
Okay, Very deep. Back to my thoughts on iOS 10.
No. We're never going to finish if we do your thoughts on iOS 10, Craig.
Even though you brought up the topic.
Come on. I had two more things, and
go ahead.
A very small thing. The swipe up thing, I preferred as a flat line instead of the rounded corners.
Of course you did.
It's dated. It matches the icons, though, so whatever. But the other thing I noticed is they changed the sleep noise. When you put your phone to sleep, it used to make this really amazing clicking sound that was just, like, really satisfying.
Yeah.
And now it's this muffled...
Oh, I love it.
...underwater click
I love thing. The new sound so much.
No,
I like the new sound for the keyboard.
The keyboard is fantastic. I love the new keyboard.
It's like, yeah.
We're not talking about the keyboard. We're talking about the sleep noise.
But they changed the noises for a lot of interactions like that. Like the keyboard, whenever you push a letter, it used to click. Now it's more of like a knock kind of a thing. And it's much more, I don't know, it's better. I like it.
That's fine. I think that is a good change because the click was really annoying.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. But the shut off sound was like one of those, it was like an iPhone thing. Like it was just really...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. It was distinctive, and I think the new sound is crappy. But anyway, whatever. Good on you, Apple. Other than that, I like it.
Shall we do the news?
Indeed we shall. This is Tech You Should Know, where we bring you a few tech news stories from the past week that we want to talk about. Twitter has finally implemented its new rules around character counts for tweets. Any media or polls you post, usernames you mention in reply, or tweets you quote in your tweet will no longer count towards your 140 character limit on your tweet. However, if you add more usernames in your tweet, those will count, as well as any links. There are also some differences with reply behavior. If you at reply someone right out of the blue, not in reply to one of their tweets, that will be seen by everyone. But if you reply something to someone's tweets that you want everyone to see, Twitter encourages you to retweet yourself. This is far more confusing than I initially thought it was, but...
Wait, say that again?
So, you know how what... Excuse me.
Yeah, you have to put a period in front of a username for everybody to see it. It's that issue?
Yes, yes. Yeah, so their solution to it is now you can retweet yourself when you at reply someone else. So you at reply someone else, then you retweet yourself so it shows up on everyone's timeline.
Oh, I don't like that.
Nah, you can still use the period thing if you want to. So, no, that's still an option.
Okay. Did anyone do or see an article on the maximum number of characters in a tweet now? I was curious.
No.
I actually was assuming that some sort of BuzzFeed-y, clickbaity thing would come out about, like, you'll never believe how many characters you can fit in a tweet now. You know, like, the longest URL you could find, the longest usernames you could find.
Yeah, yeah.
And then still the extra 140 letters. How many characters is that? People need to know, Derek.
Oh, like you don't know?
No, I don't know.
Okay. I don't know.
No,
I mean,
I have no idea.
I'm guessing, you know, however you can fit up to 50 usernames in a tweet before it starts counting against. Like if you're replying, man, that would take a long time to accumulate 50 usernames in a tweet. But, you know, that's possible.
Wait, the username only doesn't count against you if it's a reply?
Yeah. So say you have like 30 replies and each time someone adds, you know, a person or two to the thread, eventually you build it up to 50 usernames and, you know, that's how that works.
All right. I'm going to do this math real quick. Continue.
I could have sworn that that links would no longer apply though. It makes sense now that I think about it, that links still count against your character count. Cause otherwise you're going to get super spammy, tweets, but you know, oh well.
What's the longest is there a URL character limit?
I can't imagine. I would assume you can go as long as you
Oh, there want is to. A URL character limit.
Oh, there is.
Yes, 2,083 characters. There's probably something special about that number, but
wow.
Oh, wait. That's only in Internet Explorer. Interesting.
Oh.
Okay, but the maximum This is interesting. I don't know.
I'm sorry, but no URLs should be that long anyway.
that's for sure.
And that's not me being picky. That's just true.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. In this hypothetical situation, 50 usernames off of a reply. They're 15 characters max. So you'd have to find 50 15-character usernames plus the 140 characters that you normally get plus the 2,400 letters in a URL, the longest URL you could find.
But the you'd have to take the shortened URL number of characters and
crap, you're right.
Well, doesn't subtract that from the 140. So it'd still be 140 characters.
Okay, well, I thought URLs didn't count against you for like pictures and stuff.
For pictures, it doesn't. Yeah, so if you have a link that goes to a media something that
Oh, right, because they don't turn every link into a picture.
Right.
It's only the supported links. Oh, interesting.
Yep.
All right, hang on.
Yeah, some weird limitations with this, but you know, the more I think about all the various scenarios that I basically just take it from a spammer's point of view, like how can I hijack this system? And I don't think there's an easy way to hijack it. I would be
based
interested
on the work I'm having to do. I would say you're right. All right, I give up. It's somewhere around
lots.
It's definitely north of 890 because that's with 50 15-character limit usernames.
Mm,
all right, yeah. Craig is so annoyed with me now. I'm going to stop.
On to the next one. macOS Sierra has been released this week for free on the Mac App Store. Included in the update is Siri for the Mac, the ability to use Apple Pay via your iPhone. You can unlock your Mac via your Apple Watch, there are messages improvements, and much more. Update now! Unless there's an application you rely on that is dreadfully crippled by the operating system, in which case you should probably not update and yell about that company on Twitter until they get their crap together and make it work, because it's been months since they got the initial beta.
No, don't be a keyboard warrior.
Oh, but Ben, I'm really frustrated.
So, I had a local password. This is a related but not exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. I had a local password manager app on my Mac, my iMac, which was running Lion. Mm-hmm. And when I upgraded it to
Lion?
El Capitan. Wow. This was a while ago. This was actually not that long ago. It was only a couple of months ago. When I upgraded it to El Capitan, so I went through Yosemite to get there. Mm-hmm. Now it won't even let me log into the password manager app.
Hmm.
So that's a lot of resetting passwords that I need to do.
Oh dear.
Yay.
Wait, why? What password manager app did you use?
It was a Mac app, and it was called File Vault.
The File Vault is the included encryption mechanism in the OS.
Yeah, no, it wasn't that. I can't remember the name of it. It doesn't matter. I don't have it on this computer that I'm on at the moment, and it's not. I didn't have anything stored in there that I won't be able to get back ever. Okay. It's not the end of the world.
All right.
Yeah, frustrating.
Still, that stinks. You should get 1Password. Even things up between the LastPass and 1Password users on this podcast.
Oh no, it's going to be back to a Pocket Casts Overcast thing, isn't it?
OS X Lion was 6 versions ago.
I mean OS X.
Derek cringed.
Yeah, man, I didn't update my iMac for a long time because I was running Adobe CS4 and I didn't want to upgrade to CS6.
And or I figured Creative that Cloud.
Or Creative Cloud, because I spent $2,500 buying CS4 outright back when that's how you...
I don't blame you. I don't blame you.
That's how you access software, and then they made it a subscription, and I was like, no. Anyway, so CS4 still works on the later operating systems, but I just assumed it would be a bit slower or whatever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just held off for that reason.
So, have you guys... I'm assuming Craig is not upgraded to Sierra.
No, both mine are on El Capitan at the moment.
Yeah. Ben, have you upgraded?
Yes.
How do you like it?
I like it. It's not spectacularly better or...
It's not an iOS upgrade or anything.
No. Yeah. I mean, I don't think they did all... I don't know. In terms of things I actually will do differently day to day, there's not much.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't upgrade. Sorry, I'm going to get on a soapbox. But I feel like this is a public service to tell people that ScanSnap does not play nicely with Sierra. So if you have ScanSnap,
no one's heard of that app, let alone does anyone but you use it.
It's not an app.
Is it?
It's a scanner.
Hey, Derek, how's Scrivener going for you?
Oh.
Why don't you just go Scriven something, Derek?
Fine. I will. Trump off indignantly. Google's Allo has finally seen the light of day, and you can download it on iOS and Android. Allo is Google's new messaging platform, which has one distinct feature to it. In any conversation with anyone, you can use Google's Assistant to look things up or help make plans or basically do whatever you want it to. While Apple is relying on companies making apps for use in iMessage to do trip planning or movie ticket buying, Google is presenting itself as an intermediary for all things you may want to do with the friend or friends you're chatting with. The difference is that unless you enable incognito mode, which kills Google Assistant, your messages aren't end-to-end encrypted. So if you care about that sort of thing, go download WeChat or use iMessage.
Google Allo. Let Google know literally everything about you by adding it to your chat application.
That's a great tagline, Ben. You should work for Google.
Download on the App Store today.
Twitter has gotten the rights to stream the American presidential debates live. Twitter has been clearly working on making itself a media center of sorts, snagging football events as well as the Democratic and Republican national conventions so that people can gather around the old Twitter sphere and chat about live events as they happen. The first presidential debate is scheduled to air at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
Did you put the Google and Twitter stories right next to each other because of the rumor that Google might be buying Twitter?
I didn't. No, that is something new that I didn't quite get in. Well, we don't do rumors anyway.
Yeah, it's still rumory, but I wondered if you had gone all meta on us.
Twitter's been rumored to be bought out by Google like three different times already, so.
Well, the other one is Salesforce.com, which I really don't want to happen.
I don't understand that one.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Are you guys going to watch the presidential thing?
Absolutely. Yes, I am.
It is going to be entertaining at the very least.
Oh my gosh.
I would have thought depressing was the better word, but okay.
Well, you know, it depends on how you look at it. You either got to laugh or cry. So
it does depend.
Yep.
Maybe both at the same time.
Would have been way better if Gary Johnson got in there, but you know, whatever.
I don't know who that is. I'm Australian.
Independent candidate.
Ah, okay.
And as a sort of bonus topic this week, this was sent in by a listener on Twitter, there was news of an ancient burned scroll of Leviticus being able to be read by super high-tech stuff. It dates in the realm of 300 AD, because we Christians don't use that CE crap, and is important because it shows that the text of Leviticus has not changed over the past 2,000 years, and in fact, what we have today as the traditional text of Scripture is identical to this very old record. The article's pretty neat. It walks you through everything the researchers had to go through to image these burnt scrolls. You should check it out on Ars Technica.
Someone should tweet James White and let him know that exists. No, wait, don't do that. He already knows. Apparently a whole bunch of people have been telling him as if he wouldn't know before they did.
Yeah, yeah. That's all the tech you should know this week. If we left something out that you think we should have mentioned, email us at ask@techreformation.com.
And for more hashtag TYSK, follow us on Twitter at Tech Reformation.
What's this final thing?
We are about to find out.
You are. Yeah,
that's true. Silly question.
For tech you should use this week, which is the segment where we bring you interesting technology that we use and we like and explain it to you, I am presenting Final. So I'm guessing this is probably an American thing. Sorry, Craig. But what this is it's a credit card that is intelligent about, well, it's aware of the 21st century, basically, and the internet. The main draw to Final would be that you get a card, you get a physical card, of course, as you do with most credit cards. But the difference with Final is that you can generate an infinite number of credit cards in your account, like credit card numbers, virtual credit card numbers, and use them at various vendors that you use. So, say Amazon. Amazon wants to hold on to your credit card information to make it easier for you to check out. You know, you can use, One Tap Pay? One click checkout. But the thing is, you have to keep your credit card in Amazon's file, and you have to do this with a bunch of other vendors too, just for convenience's sake. So, you know, pick whatever website you shop at the most. You probably are keeping your credit card in their system, right? Well, this is a security problem, because if someone gets hacked and all of a sudden your credit card is leaked, or someone gets a hold of your credit card number somewhere, no matter what, I don't know which site you decide it is, but then you have to cancel your credit card, go through every single place that you use to pay that credit card to pay at, and change the credit card number, and it's just a huge hassle. So what Final does is you can create vendor-specific cards. So for instance, let me see what cards I have. I have a bunch of cards already. I have one for Comcast, one for Netflix, one for Amazon, one for iTunes. Once a transaction goes through on that card is locked to that merchant. So if it is used somewhere else, it automatically is disabled and can't be used anymore. And then you can go and generate a new card number and add it to, you know, whatever service it was. So this means that you can use virtual cards everywhere on the internet, and you don't have to worry about your actual card number being yanked and causing you to have to go through the process of changing over all your card numbers everywhere again. So nice. There's also the ability to use a one-time card. So if you are shopping at a site that seems maybe that you just don't shop at very much, you can just use a one-off card to check out there. Even if they hang on to your card number somewhere in their database, it is no longer useful. It's basically the security advantage of something like Apple Pay or Android Pay. So, yeah.
Well, actually,
yes.
It won't be a literal infinite number of credit card permutations because credit card numbers are 16 digits long and there are 10 possibilities for each space and they can repeat. So if you do the math, there's actually 29,059,430,400 permutations of credit card numbers.
Wow.
That are possible.
That limits me quite a bit then, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because there are 7 billion people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually only like, if everyone uses this service, 4 credit card numbers that you can have.
That's true. Now, if everyone in the world had credit cards, we probably would see the credit card industry get, like, the technology be seriously updated, like with...
Yeah, they would put chips in them so you can slide them into things instead of slide them through. That will make things slower for everyone so that people will be happy when they have to use their credit card.
I meant more along the lines of like IPv6, you know, but... you know, whatever. So yeah,
getfinal.com.
I found it incredibly useful. I've just found the experience very nice, and I don't have to worry about my cards getting hacked from some site on the internet that didn't have good enough security to keep my credit card information safe. Actually, before what I was doing was I wasn't storing my credit card everywhere, so I had to enter it every time. But now I can store it and I can have all the convenience and security. So, woohoo.
Nice.
So anyway, that's final. You can sign up. There are a lot of people that are currently signed up to get in line. So there, I was one of the early sign-uppers, so I have it already, but you should check it out. It is very nice.
Yeah, I signed up while you were talking, and I am behind 136,156 people
mm-hmm.
are ahead of me.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
But, there are cashback rewards, 1% unlimited on everything, so it's nothing fancy, but, you know, something. So, if that encourages you, then go for that. So that's the tech you should use this week. Tech Reformation is brought to you this week by Olive Tree, the Bible study software. They're committed to providing excellent Bible software and resources that enrich and encourage the study of the Bible, and they have thousands of resources, including commentaries, dictionaries, devotionals, ebooks, strong Bibles, bunch of stuff. There's a lot of various translations and languages, including like original Hebrew and Greek texts. And they've got lots of free stuff, too. You can just go into their... They have a free menu, and you can go in and select Bibles, you know, study tools, ebooks. They've got a lot on there. You can download an Albanian Bible for free. And if you want to teach yourself Albanian via the Bible, you just download your ESV and your Albanian Bible and put them in the split screen and then start comparing words and, you know, that sort of thing if you're into that kind of thing. But it is a very, very useful tool for studying scripture. You can, in that split screen, you can have commentaries, other ebooks that reference, you know, various sections of scripture, all sorts of stuff. So the Bible apps are free, on all your mobile devices, as well as your Mac and PC. You can go download it, get some free resources, check it out. They have sales all the time, so it's really easy to get started with building up your library with some inexpensive material that if you bought the books, you, first of all, you wouldn't be able to collate it in this electronic, you know, format that syncs with you everywhere. And secondly, it's way more expensive. So check out Olive Tree. And when you, if you decide to buy something, use our code TECH for 20% off, and that'll get you going. So olivetree.com. Check it out.
Hey, everyone. This is Dave Seid from the podcast Spurgeon Audio. If you're like me, you're someone who has been inspired by the work of so many great men of God who spent their lives pouring out their heart's desires for their listeners and readers to come to know Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. In this podcast, we take that love and turn it into an exploration of the sermons of Charles Spurgeon, as well as discuss the issues of the day, talk with guests, and listen to music made to rejoice in the goodness of God's glorious grace. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and your favorite podcast catcher, and of course, here on the Theology Mix Podcast Network. Join us as we podcast the Prince of Preachers to the glory of God.
Now it's time for our main topic, and this time we are going to talk about truth. So the article this week is called, it's from The Guardian, and it's called How Technology Disrupted the Truth. And you can find a link in the show notes if you want to read it. It's a bit long, but I want to summarize the little subtitle here is, social media has swallowed the news, threatening the funding of public interest reporting and ushering in an era when everyone has their own facts. But the consequences go far beyond journalism. Dun dun dun. Thank you, Derek.
You're welcome.
All right. So, for those that don't read it, and I would encourage you to read it. It's a well-written article. It's just long. Mm-hmm. I would just summarize that the article makes two main points, I think. One, and both of these things are, I think they're arguing, inherent in technology. So number one, technology causes us to be postmodern. And number two, technology causes us to be in an echo chamber. And just for the purposes of this discussion, we probably should define postmodern. And I'm sure there are a lot of definitions out there, and I don't mean to be exhaustive here. But the definition I'm going with is something along the lines of post-truth. So the idea that there's not objective truth out there, that everything is subjective. You might have heard the phrase, your truth is your truth, and that's fine for you, but I've got my own truth kind of thing. And that's kind of what we're talking about when we say postmodern, at least for our purposes. Mm-hmm. So there may be other definitions, but that's kind of what I'm boiling it all down to. So she's saying, this author is saying that technology causes us to be postmodern, and it causes us to be in an echo chamber. Here's a good quote on the second point. Algorithms such as the one that powers Facebook's newsfeed are designed to give us more of what they think we want, which means that the version of the world we encounter every day in our own personal stream has been invisibly curated to reinforce our pre-existing beliefs. When Eli Pariser, the co-founder of Upworthy, coined the term, quote, filter bubble in 2011, he was talking about how the personalized web, and in particular Google's personalized search function, which means that no two people's Google searches are the same, means that we are less likely to be exposed to information that challenges us or broadens our worldview, and less likely to encounter facts that disprove false information that others have shared. So the idea of being in an echo chamber is, I'm hearing my own voice or voices that sound like mine, and so I'm just being reinforced in my beliefs that I came in with because that's all I hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've heard that a lot, especially when talking about Facebook, especially, because and there's been like. Who was it that did? There was somebody who there was some news organization that put a feature where you could switch from a liberal version of Facebook to a conservative version of Facebook and like compare the two and see which, you know, see what people were seeing. I'll have to find it. But
doesn't the article about Facebook suppressing the top articles, you know, from conservative sources, doesn't that kind of disprove this point or no?
No, that has to do with the trending topics. But what...
Right,
this,
yeah.
But...
this is talking about the personalized news feed, of course.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
that
exactly, that sort of thing. Even with Google, you're going to have personalized search results. So that when you're looking up for a particular political topic, you will likely... Because Google knows a lot about you and what you search for, it will figure out, you know, what searches you want to see, which is why Google is very excellent at searches. That also means that you'll find the things that agree with you most of the time.
And that's the point of these platforms in one sense, right?
Right.
The way that they make money is by keeping you on their platform because
Precisely.
They're, at least with Google, and I think you could argue with Facebook also, their main source of revenue is ads. And the way they get money for ads is by clicks and views and things. And so the longer you're sitting on Facebook and looking at those ads, or at least they're on your screen, the more money Facebook can charge the companies that give them that sell them ads, mm-hmm. or that they sell ads to, sorry. And so, you know, in one sense, it makes sense for Google and Facebook and whoever to personalize your newsfeed to stuff you want to see because it keeps you there longer so that you can see those ads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, I get why it is the way that it is. I think the point stands. I think that she's right that we are more likely to be in echo chambers because of things like this, because mm-hmm. of the technology around us. Do you guys think that point stands?
Absolutely.
Yeah, enough. Yep.
What about the first point that technology causes us to be postmodern?
That one's a little bit different, I think.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
I can't remember exactly the wording that you used about postmodernism in your definition, Ben, but to me, postmodernism is summarized by a feeling of having the authority to question anything and everything, and in questioning truth is just as valid as truth itself. If not more valid. So the idea that there may not be any truth and that's okay. So it kind of leads to like a relativistic society or something.
Right. Yeah, I think it has less to do with asking questions. I know we went with that kind of in a previous episode, but I actually don't really like the way we defined it there. I think it has less to do with asking questions and more to do with subjective truth and relative truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the idea of being postmodern is that you're after the modern period. And in the modern period, people affirmed that there is truth out there somewhere and we can find it. We have to find it. But in the postmodern era, the idea is that there isn't truth out there, that you decide the truth for yourself. And that's kind of what you're getting at with your autonomous comment. I'm with you there.
Yeah, it's a subverting of authority thing. So really, whatever way you want to define it, whether you want to talk about questioning authority or... whatever, at the end of the day, it does lead to relativism. We'd all agree with that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah. Subjectivism.
And so, I think technology can maybe enhance that, but I wouldn't say it's the root cause of that.
So, the reason... that makes sense. The reason that... I'm not sure I agree. I think I agree with both points of this article. But yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about. The reason that she says that technology causes us to be postmodern is because of the publishing platform of the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
So she compares, there's a lot of examples she uses at the beginning of the article of stories that got a lot of publicity very quickly that sort of went viral, if you will, that actually turned out not to be true. Or like she even uses the Brexit example, which we've talked about in a previous show, of just things being spread very quickly that aren't exactly the whole story or even the true story. And so she attributes to this postmodernism that's caused by the technology to the publishing platform. Basically, anyone can say whatever they want, mm-hmm. and things spread and are caused to be heard and accepted because they're viral rather than because they're fact or because they're true.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's kind of her reasoning behind it, I think, mainly.
That's probably fair. I think I'd clarify just quickly to say that maybe I don't agree with fully with the fact that it's only modern technology that causes this. I think that if you're using the word technology broadly, then I would say that's pretty accurate, because surely from, like, it wouldn't just be the internet that's caused that, for example. Probably from the printing press onwards, as people were able to publish more easily than they could before and get information out, more people could get more information out to whoever was willing to read it.
Yeah, yeah.
Even that level of technology would have been a big way of having multiple, you know, more voices than there had been in the past, and therefore more people willing to believe those different voices.
And sort of the twofold shift of going from the printing press to social media is something that she brings up also, that causes sort of this relativism in what's viral being popular and accepted. Derek, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say something along the lines of what Craig did, but I do think that certainly the way that anyone can publish anything, and it's not going to be like, you can see, you, when you go to a website, you kind of have an idea of, does this website look legit? Like, there's a certain look to a legitimate website, right? And it's not that hard to fake anymore. Like, the look of legitimacy is not difficult to create for yourself. When it happened, like, with books even, I mean, even with the printing press, yeah, the printing press enabled a lot more voices to be heard and a lot more voices to be quote-unquote official than whatever they were doing before that, and writing on stone tablets, or it wasn't that, but like papyrus, and just like handing that around or whatever. Or it would be like, you would have, like, before the printing press, it would be way more about people who are well known saying things, and those are the people that kind of have the prime truth of society, and we're just lowly people who read that. Whereas with the advent of the printing press, you know, there's more people who are us lowly that can talk about what we think, and thus it fragments the knowledge base of the world into lots and lots more truths. And then even with the internet, it kind of has come to a head where you have everyone being able to create something that looks legitimate and make their opinion known, and it looks legitimate. Like, you can, people can make websites that, you know, look like The Guardian, and they can write a lot of words that kind of make sense. And so you get this, such an influx of information that it seems like nothing is true anymore. Like, everything is true. Everyone has a legitimate opinion. I think that's a huge reason for why post-modernity has really found its niche in society nowadays. Just because the formats have changed. Technology has changed, and that affected the way we think.
Yep. She comments in the article, "In the digital age, it is easier than ever to publish false information, which is quickly shared and taken to be true,
yep,
as we often see in emergency situations when news is breaking in real time." And then she lists examples of this. I thought of the Boston Marathon bombing, for example, when there was a suspect who everyone was saying did it, and he was an innocent man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's a clear example of that. I think another helpful quote here is this: "Increasingly, what counts as fact is merely a view that someone feels to be true, and technology has made it very easy for these, quote, facts to circulate with a speed and reach that was unimaginable in the Gutenberg era or even a decade ago,"
mm-hmm,
which I think is exactly what we're getting at here. So in general, I tend to agree with the two points. I can see why technology today causes us to be postmodern and it causes us to be in an echo chamber. I think the challenge for us as Christians is to avoid those, to resist, maybe I should say, those tendencies when we use our technology. I did think it was really, really interesting that the whole time, given this argument in this article, the author is essentially arguing that this isn't a good thing. Neither one of these things is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That when, you know, when a fact resembles, she says, when a fact resembles to,
She says, when a fact begins to resemble whatever you feel is true, it becomes very difficult for anyone to tell the difference between facts that are true and facts that are not. Mm-hmm. And the word facts in the second place is in quotes, obviously, because a fact is true by definition. And that's the trouble. We have so much trouble having a conversation even because we can't even define our words anymore.
Yeah.
When we all become postmodern. I thought it was great that the author sees the issue with both of these things. And essentially the way I put it is, I love it when the world can't escape God's design. Because we know, you know, God created this world and ordered it in such a way that certain things are just true. There is truth, for example. There is objective truth. And we kind of, as his creation, can't escape that. And this, I think, is evidence of that.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I agree too. I think what the world tries to do is stick its head in the sand on this issue, though, and say that that truth is something that's maybe not that it doesn't exist. I think some people say that. I think other people say that truth exists and it's somewhat universal, but it's also malleable, and therefore a society can define its own truth. Or like I have a close friend who used to be a believer and profess that he was a believer, and now would say the opposite of that. And he, I spoke to him a while ago on Skype, and he was just saying that his worldview continues to change every few years, in a fairly dramatic sense. And I was saying, so don't you feel like then that you're standing on a foundation that's quite sandy and you keep sort of reshuffling and rearranging it to make sense of where you're at in that period of your life? And then down the track, you have to sort of throw a whole bunch of things out of the window and start again in some areas. And he said, yep, and I'm totally okay with that because that's where society is heading. And that kind of, I don't know, seems like a really weird way of living your life to me. And for us as Christians, like part of the not being able to escape God's design and believing in that we're all created in the image of God is seeing that you can't actually make sense even of your own ability to rationalize your worldview and where it's come from and where it's heading without being able to say that there is objective truth. Mm-hmm. It's just a precursor to being able to make sense of the world we live in. So people can try and ignore that or downplay it, but I don't think they can ever actually entirely get rid of it.
To me, what this author keys in on is Romans 1:22, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of God, of the immortal God, for images. And it goes on. But when we can't even have a conversation anymore because we can't agree on the definition of words, you know, I mean, that is the definition of claiming to be wise and yet becoming fools. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just futile in our thinking and our foolish hearts are darkened. You know, and like the preceding verses, that God's wrath is revealed against this kind of behavior, those who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. What can be known about God is plain because God's shown it to us, because in creation, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived, so that we're all without excuse. And this is exactly why we send missionaries, because people by nature are in a relationship to God that is characterized by condemnation and wrath. And we want people to know about Jesus because he's the only one, his is the only name under heaven by which men can be saved, that he's absorbed the condemnation and the wrath that we might not have condemnation in him.
That says it better than I could. So,
well,
I'm good.
That's because it's the Bible. It says it better than I could too. Well, do you guys have any recos?
Kinda. There is a new Crowder album.
Oh, yeah.
Which I haven't listened to yet. But,
did you listen to the single that he put out a week or two ago? Like the teaser one?
I did. I did. I don't remember it. But it's okay. Crowder, so it's gonna be good. So
it'll be very good.
Just go buy it.
And get the deluxe album. It's always worth getting his deluxe albums. Yes. And get all the extra bits and pieces that other people don't get.
Yes.
They're quite often worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Greg, do you have any recos?
I concur with Derek's reco.
Awesome.
Derek and Craig recommend the new Crowder album.
That's right.
Let me update the show notes to accurately reflect the truth. Well, if you would like to connect with us, you can jump in our Slack team. Sign up at slack.techreformation.com.
And you can visit our website to search for past shows and topics. Just head to techreformation.com.
We are a part of the Theology Mix Network. You can check out their website and iTunes master feed in the show notes.
Don't forget to review us on iTunes. We need some stars and some words so that we can get out there to more folks like you who love technology and theology.
And even if you just would like to share us with one person that you know is kind of a techie and kind of into theology, just share us with them. Let's see what they think. One-to-one, like personal recommendations are some of the best ways you can help us get to more people. So go for that.
Agreed. If you like the music you've been hearing, it is used by special permission of Mr. Matthew Parker. We're grateful to him. Check him out on SoundCloud and iTunes. This has been Tech Reformation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. But the consequences go far beyond journalism. I was going to do dun dun dun, and then I choked up. Oh gosh, I'm sorry. You have to cut that out.
Yeah. You can feel free to still do the dun 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 thing, though.
Dun dun dun.